Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 4th of October, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives and also David Scott. David, of course, bringing us northern exposure from north of the border. Well, things get ever more serious.
Well, interesting. Anyway, so here's Boris yesterday. In the Commons, Mr. Speaker, the previous withdrawal agreement and political declaration would have permanently anchored the United Kingdom within the orbit of EU regulation and customs arrangements. Well, that is a very interesting statement, part of the statement that he made yesterday. Now, he's given his final offer plans to the EU in a letter to Jean-Claude Juncker, and the EU hasn't, at least hadn't, as we're coming to the programme, formally replied. Certainly, most of the media is suggesting that it's all going to end in disaster. He's been given, allegedly, until the 11th of October to change the offer. And if there's no progress by that deadline, then we're heading back towards no deal, apparently. And then he's going to start an EU trip. He's going to head round all the leaders of the European member states next week to try and convince them to back him. So, what's in this agreement? Well, Northern Ireland is going to leave the customs union with the rest of the UK, but it's going to stay in the single market. That would create an all-island regulatory zone. So this is what we were talking about on Monday, with effectively a border down the Irish Sea, which seems a bit similar to the backstop to me. Goods from Britain to Northern Ireland would be managed by this border in the Irish Sea, but the checks are only in the direction from Britain to Northern Ireland, not from Northern Ireland to Britain. So that's slightly different. And then, of course, is this business that this all-island regulatory zone would have to be approved by the population of Northern Ireland through the Northern Ireland Assembly. So, David Scott, first of all, welcome to the programme. I'm just wondering how this deal that Boris is proposing is different from the backstop?
Well, the backstop had a border in the Irish Sea. This one has a bit of a border in the Irish Sea, but it also has a border in Ireland, between Northern Ireland and the EU, and that's new. And it also has, instead of all the control being with the EU, now some of the control is given to the political institution of Northern Ireland.
That would be the political institution in Northern Ireland that doesn't actually exist and hasn't existed since Sinn Féin withdrew their support for the Northern Ireland Assembly a couple of years ago as a result of the green energy scam, which they blame the Democratic Unionist Party of being behind.
Yes, Mike, that's the one. I mean, that political body will have some control. So, what could go wrong with that? So it is different, and it is compromise. It is a compromise position, and it actually has been, given the situation, quite surprisingly well received, even by those hostile to it, apart from people who don't think like Jeremy Corbyn. But in terms of the response from Ireland and the response from Northern Ireland and the response from the EU, it seems to have been, shall we say, a successfully crafted compromise?
Well, of course, the DUP is going to support it, but they're dropping all this notion of opposition to a border in the Irish Sea at the moment because, of course, there's more cash for Northern Ireland listed in it. So there's a promise of a new deal for Northern Ireland. So that's £1 billion bung to support Theresa May in it as their confidence and supply partners. Further bungs that we mentioned on Monday's programme, and now a new bung, which is called the New Deal for Northern Ireland, which guarantees more support. So this is costing the British taxpayer almost as much as the European Union did.
It's pricey, and it does show that cash is king. And also, I would point out that the New Deal for Northern Ireland is named after the New Deal in America, which is the reason that the Great Depression was great. Right, the New Deal was so unsuccessful that in 1937, in the middle of the biggest depression in the history of economic history, There was actually a recession within the Depression because of the New Deal and the policies that it involved. And it in fact took World War II and the death of the person who instigated the New Deal in order for the American economy to recover. So, yeah, nice name.
So can I just get that right? So Boris bungs the Depression within the recession. This is how the whole thing works.
Apparently.
And somebody's just said this smacks of betrayal. And I think they could be right.
Well, you mentioned the thoughts of Jeremy Corbyn. Let's just have a brief listen to the thoughts of Jeremy Corbyn and Boris's response to them.
But what we have before us is a rehashed version of previously rejected proposals that put the Good Friday Agreement at risk, that would trigger a race to the bottom on rights and protections for workers, consumers and our precious environment.
I think that, this is a very good basis for a deal, and to take his points in turn and to take his questions seriously, Mr. Speaker, he asks what is the advantage of this deal over the previous withdrawal agreement, and very simply it is this, Mr. Speaker, that the objections on all sides of the House to the previous withdrawal agreement were based on the backstop, which, as the right honourable gentleman knows, keeps the UK locked in the customs union and in the single market with no say on those arrangements. And, Mr. Speaker, I listened very carefully to honourable members on all sides of the House during those debates, and that was the burden of the House's objections to the backstop.
So, David, it seems to me, and please correct me if you've got a different view, but it seems to me that what we have here is exactly what we predicted we would have a few weeks ago. We have Theresa May's deal back on the table with a slight amendment to the backstop.
Well, quite possibly. There's some other clips that are coming up that show shed amazing light onto this, and that also show a huge amount of movement, that we're dealing with a situation that is still enormously fluid, and that public opinion, particularly with regards military union, is having enormous effect now on government policy. But that certainly, what you described there, Mike, certainly seems to be the starting point, yes, the point where we are today.
Right. So let's come on to this issue of defence union then, and let's bring Steve Baker, MP, onto the screen. Now, he's the chairman of the ERG, he was speaking at a fringe meeting of the Tory Party conference just a few days ago, and this is what he had to say.
So the backstop's got to go. The political declaration would have to point to a destination of the character they offered us, so security cooperation, a full free trade agreement, research, innovation, education, cultural, dealing with all those things, completely fine. Some settlement on the money.
So that's quite an interesting statement. What he's saying there is that we have a political declaration under Theresa May's deal, and that political declaration expressed the future relationship that the UK would have with the European Union, assuming that Theresa May's deal had passed. And what he's saying there is that any future political declaration would have to include the same types of things. And the first item that he chose on his list was security. And of course, that, as we already know from other government documents, that includes defence. So that was a few days ago. And then yesterday, Steve Baker was on the BBC and he had this to say.
So even if this package, just to be clear, even if this package is somehow agreed with the EU, you are saying very clearly that that still wouldn't be enough for you to be happy with it.
So I'm afraid this is a very difficult moment, because this package deals with the issue of the Northern Ireland backstop. And on that point, it's very good. But we do need to see the future destination in full, because there are many people out there very concerned about the defence and security provisions in the current political declaration. That needs to be addressed. So I'm afraid this is a moment where I'm cautiously optimistic, as they say. I wish to support the Prime Minister. He made a fantastic speech today. He's the Prime Minister I always wanted. He's doing all the right things. He's doing an amazing job.
So, David Ellis, let's bring you onto the programme now. Welcome to the programme. In a matter of a couple of days, he seems to have done a 180-degree turn. So at one point a few days ago, he's suggesting that he supports the idea of security cooperation with the EU, as in the current political declaration. And now he's saying that that's no longer the case. So what's caused that, do you think?
Public pressure. Over a million views of Simon Bean's warning. I think probably collectively all the work that we're doing and the briefings from General Riley and Admiral Roger Lane Knott, I think collectively what's happened between Tory party conference, clearly, where he was all fine and dandy with it, you know, we'll still carry on with the code words, security, which is all of it, as you rightly said, it's everything. To now all of a sudden he's had a promotion, clearly, because he's got on the BBC, so there's something gone on there. And there are concerns with defence and security. And I think he mentions that many people out there, does he say, have got concerns about defence and security. Well, what we've got concerns with, Steve, is what is the situation with Defence Union? And you're still not using the magic words, are you? So you're nearly there. So he's going to need a bit more. He's going to need a bit more public encouragement, isn't he?
Indeed.
I was just going to say, perhaps we just add in there for somebody who may be new to this particular aspect of the discussion. This is the UK's military and security services, defence industries, procurement, all being signed into EU Defence Union, which is still there, even if Brexit was declared. Or we are very sure it's still there, because at the moment the government doesn't want to declare how deep it's gone into Defence Union. David, is there anything else we can say to people who are perhaps new to this subject? David Ellis, sorry, of EU Defence Union. Because it's very subtle. We've got a subject which, up until now, the government simply hasn't wanted to talk about, and neither has the Labour or the Lib Dem parties, nor the Brexit party, come to that.
Right. Well, OK, let's take it from the top down. So, as far as the parties are concerned, the best information that I've got is from a former full Trident admiral who stated that there was a pact to keep quiet on defence with the parties. So that pact envelops this particular massive facet in our future concerns and policy with defence as to whether we're in EU Defence Union or whether we stay as a nation and choose to do what we want to do under some kind of sovereign aspect. So what can people do? All right, when they write into their MP, and I'm suggesting that that's what they do, that they, if you can, post what you've written in openly on Twitter or Facebook or any kind of medium like that and corner the MP and tell them, you know, actually make it broadcast. It's open, you know, make it open source that you want to know what is the government position currently on membership of EU Defence Union and what does that entail? And state in your letter, you are not, clearly not writing about EU Army. We know that doesn't exist. We want to know about EU Defence Union and what's happening with that. And we've got to double down, because a lot of letters have been written in recently over the last few weeks. A lot of them have been fielded back to me, and they're the same template letters we've been seeing for 2 years. Nothing's changed. So we've got to double down, because what the MPs are doing, they're obviously all effectively like mushrooms. None of them are doing their job properly. And they just simply get this template letter from somewhere within the bowels of the organisation and they just push it out to the general public. Well, you don't get fobbed off with that. Go back to them immediately. Ask for an appointment or something. You know, politics is best done face-to-face, I think, or I've always felt. Go back in there. No, I'm not talking about EU Army. That doesn't exist, all right? I'm talking about Defence Union. That does exist, and we apparently are in it, because Ben Wallace doesn't know what the legal position is.
Yes, we will be coming on to that.
Let's do that.
Yeah, but just before we do that, let me ask David Scott again. This change in position, because as a result of pressure coming on from the public, it's palpable.
It's palpable, and it's we've been pushing at this for 3 years, and for 3 years it's been like trying to debate an iceberg, you know, it's got so much mass and it just moves slowly forward and it seems that there's not much you can do. In the last 2-3 weeks, that's changed more than ever before. We're seeing complete reversals. We're about to see the fact that the Minister of Defence is all at sea, and we're seeing via the work of Simon Bean, via the Russi briefings, which I think Steve Baker was at. I think he attended that. And all this information is coming to the public floor, all this information is coming into the public sphere, and people who were saying to us, go away, you're rocking the boat, are now turning around and saying, no, you're right. And we have no answer, and we're very worried. I've never seen a shift at such high level like this before. It's all of a sudden, defence union is now coming to the very top of the political agenda, and there is panic, and there is movement, and there is everything to play for.
Absolutely, everything to play for. Now, yes, David Ellis.
That's critical. And the reason for that is because once the general public, once there's a sufficient number of people in the country, let's say 17 million or 17.4 million or maybe more, 20, 25 million if the Remainers want to be interested as well, because it concerns them as much as it does everyone else. Once the general public is aware of something called defence union, they're going to go, well, hang on a minute, we're supposed to be leaving. How on earth can we be going into defence union in parliamentary silence with no debate, no vote, and yet we are leaving? It becomes the Brexit paradox. This is an impossible position for the government to be in, or any of those politicians, because what it does is it goes, wow, you lot are all completely naked politically. The whole facade of all this tosh that we've been going through for the last 2 years is all undone in a matter of moments.
As it should be.
That's the significance of it.
Perhaps this would be a good time just to bring in the fact that we know that some veterans have been put under huge pressure the moment they've started to speak out to their followers about EU defence union. Simon Bean, of course, gave that brilliant explanation as to what was happening, and vast numbers of veterans and his supporters picked up on it. But we understand that some other veterans have actually been quite seriously threatened by the establishment from the moment they've been talking about EU defence union. This is absolutely appalling, but it shows, I think, a sense of fear in the government. This is cornered rats, that they are prepared to threaten veterans to try and silence them on the issue of EU defence union.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a very dangerous game because of the kind of people that are at the end of that. And I've got to say that my understanding is of the individual that has received, you know, this treatment, if you want to call it that, this disgusting treatment, has got very severe PTSD. So this is doubly wrong and awful on so many levels. But of course, it's going to backfire. It's going to backfire spectacularly on those politicians that have chosen to remain silent, and the government and all of the people there that have been doing this, because their position is frankly untenable. If this is revealed, that it'll literally, as far as I'm aware, we've got a very senior ex-minister has just said, this has effectively sunk the government.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to Ben Wallace, who is, of course, our illustrious Defence Secretary. And this is a few days ago. He was at the Tory Party conference, and on the fringes of that, Conservative Home held an event, I suppose you could say, sponsored by Raytheon, where they were discussing defence. And one of the first point that Ben Wallace made, the first serious point that he made, was with respect to sovereignty. So let's have a listen to this.
I mean, we talk about sovereignty and we value our sovereignty, but any treaty organisation, you in a sense pool your sovereignty. So, you know, NATO Article 5 is the United Kingdom giving up some of its sovereignty based on a precondition that we will come to mutual self-defence of other countries. That's us giving away our sovereignty. It's no different than another type of giving away sovereignty.
So obviously one of the key concerns about EU Defence Union, just as with any other policy area in the EU, is that you would have to give up sovereignty over your armed forces, David Ellis. And he's arguing, it seems, that we don't have to worry about that because we're already in NATO and that's the same type of arrangement. But in fact, if you look at Article 5, situation in NATO is that every individual member state of NATO has makes their own decision about whether it's appropriate to take part in an Article 5 joint operation where that clause is invoked. So it's not like defence union at all.
No, it tells us a great deal here. One, he's trying to manipulate the situation and wash out the severity of it by making an incorrect analogy. And clearly, sovereignty is of great concern, and they know it. That's why they're talking about it. And he's attempting there to wash the story away. He's incorrect with the way that he's viewing the NATO situation, because NATO is a collective of sovereign nations that make those decisions on a sovereign basis. So that's a complete load of tosh. And for him to attempt to come and do this, because he, all through the clips that everyone's about to see, that being the first, at no point does he use the correct and specific terms of reference of EU Defence Union. Mentions the pillars, but of course, once he's very, very conscious, he's very aware not to use that phrase. I'm going to submit that he's probably been briefed. Don't say that. But he wants to talk about sovereignty because he knows that's a problem. And he wants to say, well, there's nothing, don't worry about it. There's nothing to see. You know, it's not a problem because we're already doing that. It's fine. Well, it's not fine. And he's wrong.
Yeah.
If I just add a bit here, of course, that room was packed because at the beginning when the host, who is another gentleman called Wallace, no relation between the two, but he says we must make room because the room itself is packed, come round to the side. So we know that there are a lot of people in there. And the only thing we can assume is that word is now spreading and there were a lot of Tories in that room trying to find out what was the situation about issues connected to our sovereignty and control of our armed forces. And I've got to remind people at this point that this meeting was sponsored by the American arms manufacturer Raytheon. So we've now got the situation where for the British public to find out what's actually happening with their armed forces, control of the armed forces going to EU Defence Union, we're reliant on the Tory party being hosted by an American defence manufacturer, Raytheon. And our defence minister at one stage even apologised to Raytheon because he dared to mention another company's name who was a competitor. So I've got to come back on this, David, and say what's outrageous about this meeting is this debate and the questioning should have taken place in Westminster. But of course, as you've said, there's a pact of silence. And so the British public is treated so appallingly, we have to rely on video that really only the UK column is pushing out or emphasising.
Right, but the question then is, if they went there to get information about this, were they going to get any information about this?
Yeah.
So let's listen to this.
I mean, I've looked at some of the debate, and there is a debate. It's a sort of lawyer's debate between whether it is actually the case that if we were to join some European organisations, as in not join but voluntary contribute to missions, would that make us subject to European sovereignty or issues? And I think there are some valid criticisms from some of the sort of veterans of Brexit. But I've also asked that, you know, we look at that in detail going forward with lawyers to make sure that we're exactly sure of whether we'll be locked into things or not.
Just to pick up on part of what you said, the implication of getting together with the lawyers to look at the detail of what we are or aren't committed to is that at the moment we're not sure what we're currently committed to.
Well, I think it depends on... So I looked at the recent lectures that were at RUSI. I watched them online. And I also went back into the most exciting document of all, you know, the withdrawal agreement and the political declaration. And you go through what does, you know, page 94 mean and all that stuff. And I think some of it depends on your view. If you join up all the pillars, the European Defence Agency, the European Defence Fund, PESCO, which is a European sort of coordination centre, and some of the other stuff, the number of pillars there are. If you collectively put them all in one, does that bind you in? But if they're all voluntary by condition of entry, you know, does that mean you are able to pull in or out? And I think there are really important questions in all of that.
So, David Scott, there are really important questions in all of that. And the thing, There was a question from somebody to me on Twitter yesterday about this whole situation, and the thing that I've been particularly confused about over the last few years is the political declaration makes some statements about our future relationship with the EU with respect to defence, but what it doesn't do is give any indication what obligations we're already under as a result of being involved in bilateral agreements with the French, the Germans, the Dutch and the Italians and a whole host of other countries in the EU. Also our membership of NATO, because NATO also has a relationship with the EU with respect to defence union. And what we have here is a total rat's nest of international treaties. And he clearly, Ben Wallace, clearly does not have a clue how these things all interact and react together and what obligations that puts on the UK. So question to you is part of the reason that the government is utterly silent on this, because could it really be that they genuinely don't know?
Well, it seems that Ben Wallace knows nothing. It seems that Ben Wallace, the Secretary of State for Defence, is going to have to ask a grown-up what the words in the May political agreement mean. He should read our stuff. It's all on the website. It's not complicated language. He doesn't know how many pillars there are, but he's using the word pillars, so he's seen the diagram. He's seen the diagram with the foundation, there's the political will, and then all the pillars line up in the EU. NATO's one corner and bilateral agreements another, and there's eight pillars, and then the pediment on top is EU military union. So he knows he's talking about, he's referring to pillars, he's seen the diagram, he knows it's a diagram describing EU military union, but he doesn't use the word, he doesn't use the phrase, and he pretends not to understand what's happening. It's too complicated. I'm just a humble servant and a politician. How could I possibly know what's going on here? I'm only the Minister of Defence. That was one of the most remarkable couple of minutes of video I think I've ever seen.
David Ellis, what are your thoughts on this?
This is the biggest reveal we've had of the situation there from somebody that professes to be a politician on this issue, because there clearly is a position. And he doesn't know what the position is. He's not really sure of the detail. I don't think he's read the manual properly. He's frankly supercilious in his demeanour. And I don't see that there's the regard that's really appropriate for this level of state matters. And there's a huge problem with respect, because he's got 4 million veterans out there in Britain with families that this... and everybody else that pays tax and everything that wants to keep safe, that this is going to be a factor for. So I think he gives the game away critically in this one comment. It's a lawyer's debate. Now, what is he saying to us there, ladies and gentlemen? That it's not political. It's not party or parties. Nothing to do with a mandate and nothing to do with a vote. This is a lawyer's debate now. So he's attempting to absolve himself from any responsibility here, I think. I'd love to hear his argument. If he wants to engage in that, that would be great. But the silence, of course, at the whole political end really is going back to the Brexit paradox, you know, that we're going into defence union in silence and there's going to be a bill. And that's now a lawyer's debate. So there is a position and he can't tell us what the position is. And obviously that's great, because that means we're going to keep it silent for quite a while. And I suspect really what he was doing in there, and fair play to Mark Wallace there, the guy interviewing him, who's at least managed to get thus far with it. So all credit to him. But obviously what he was trying to do in that meeting was to stabilise those stalwart Tories and not mention defence union. And that's the key things. He does not want those members even hearing the phrase defence union. That is the critical part of all of this. that if we have a sufficient number of people in the country aware of the thing and the phrase defence union, it will all come undone because people will start talking about it. And as soon as we have a majority knowing that there is something, they talk about it, it'll bring it to a head and a stop. Because the British people won't support this. I fundamentally believe that. And he, frankly, there has probably made the biggest, he's probably helped us more than anyone else in this cause. So, you know, at the moment, whilst I'm annoyed with him, I'm actually very happy with him because of what he's done, because he's given us this terrific clip where he's basically acknowledged that there is a position. He can't tell us what the position is because he doesn't know. And he's the Secretary of State. He doesn't know whether we are committed to defence union or not.
Okay, but you're talking about silence. Perhaps the silence is in the process of being broken. So let's hear what, because following the initial exchanges with Boris yesterday afternoon, this question was asked.
But may I ask him a question which a lot of my constituents are asking me, that when we finally leave on the 31st of October, that if it were to be without a deal, there will be no adverse effect on any UK-European defence collaboration, especially in the field of procurement, manufacture and wider operations?
I'm grateful to my honourable friend, and I can tell him that we are proceeding with a huge collaborations across the front with our European friends, and I have no reason to believe that any of them will be interrupted.
So, David Ellis, is that the beginning of the breaking of the silence?
It's got to be, isn't it? Because he does everything there than actually say defence union. Huge collaborations on, does he say many fronts?
Yes, he does.
Interesting that he says fronts, isn't it? And we've got Jack Lopresti there asking the question. I met Jack Lopresti about 18 months ago at a backbench 1922 defence committee. So it's the 1922 old boy backbench Tories have their own defence committee. And he was chairing it at the time, along with, I think he was sitting there with John Redwood and one or two other people, where they were being, where they were talking about the commitments from Major General Tim Cross. And again, at that meeting, they were not mentioning the defence union was never mentioned, but the workings were mentioned. So I find it ironic that he's now all of a sudden becoming interested. But as my understanding is, he's asking that defence union continues and we're seeking assurances that it will not be interrupted. And Boris says he's confirming that there's going to be no interruption regardless of Brexit. And we're proceeding with a huge collaboration. So basically, the huge collaboration is defence union. That's the way I'm interpreting that.
Is that how you're interpreting it, David Scott?
We had a fascinating moment. David identified it there. The words that Boris used weren't quite right. He said, huge collaborations across the... Now, the next word should have been board, right? He should have said across the board, meaning across a range of areas. But he didn't. He said across the front. Now, I just, what did he mean there? Because it's a bit of a Freudian slip, right? Okay, it's a military metaphor, but it doesn't fit as a military metaphor. What does front mean? Front is short for front line. Well, there isn't a front line, so what does he mean? He's talking about front line forces. He's talking about huge collaborations across the front line forces of Her Majesty's Armed Services. That was a Freudian slip. That was showing that it's not organisational and in terms of infrastructure and all the rest of it only. It's front line, right? It's where our young men and young women will go and what they will do and where their lives will be put on the line. That's what he said there. Yep. And he also said that there was nothing that he was aware of that would interdict that and stop it. But I thought that was actually slightly weak. Nothing that he's aware of. Well, he's only the Prime Minister. But there's been a lot of change in a week. Let's see what he says next week.
Yes.
Okay, well, of course, one of the things that UK columnists consistently spelt out is that Britain's armed forces were cut, decimated in order to achieve sort of parity levels with other European countries to ease in EU defence union. And the cuts and manipulation still going on in UK. We'll just bring this one in. This is Plymouth Live reporting that the Royal Marines official Stonehouse Barracks is going to close, and they're talking, remind myself of the date, 2027 here. So at the moment we've got the situation where what they describe as the spiritual home of the Royal Marines dating back to 1785, that's going to close. Don't know where the Royal Marines are going to be housed. So there's a lot of waffle about hot water problems. Now what's going on here is very, very cynical, and we're seeing it in other areas of the military. If you want to completely change Britain's military and lock it into the EU system, you've got to get rid of the national history. You do not want people being able to associate Royal Marines with a base that's 200 plus years old. You've got to get rid of all that history so that the young officers and other ranks have got nothing to grip hold of with the nation state. So I think this is a very, very dangerous and cynical move now to alienate the Royal Marines. What have we got? Johnny Mercer, our local Plymouth MP, who boasts of his military background and how he's supporting the veterans. He's been bigging up on the fact that the government suddenly found money in the middle of this Brexit mire to be refurbishing not only the local hospital, but other hospitals. So we haven't seen Johnny Mercer speaking out on EU Defence Union. He's run away a bit like the proverbial rabbit on that. Neither have we seen him supporting the veterans who've been put under pressure. Well, perhaps he has, but we haven't seen the evidence for him supporting the veterans. So I think at the moment we're looking for any politician who's got some guts to stand up and really talk about what's going on. Mm-hmm. Certainly it's not to be found locally.
Now, Wednesday after the news programme, it was officially announced through the government that Boris is going to have another go at proroguing Parliament. So he's intending to close Parliament on Tuesday, the 8th of October, with a Queen's speech on Monday, the 14th of October. Through a Queen's speech, he said the government will set out its plans, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to read that. You get the point. So we'll be interested to see what happens next. But of course, since Parliament came back, there's been very little actual activity there, so hopefully there won't be any major problems about that this time. David Scott, the Scottish courts, there's still activity there with respect to Boris, the BBC reporting that the Scottish court is considering whether Boris Johnson could be imprisoned if there's a no deal.
Yes, the BBC, bless them, managed to consider this without actually at any point discussing the enormous constitutional crisis that we would get if a court locked up a sitting prime minister for the crime of honouring both his manifesto commitments and the express will of the people in the largest mass democracy event in the history of the country. The fact that the BBC, and apparently Joanne Cherry and a few other interesting people, and maybe we will see the Court of Session, think that that's a viable way forward, shows the degree to which there is desperation bordering on lunacy. But let's look a little bit deeper into what the Court of Session are saying. So the legal action's been initiated by businessman Dale Vince, more on him in a moment, QC Joe Mohan and SNP MP Joanna Cherry. They want the Court of Session to rule on the extent to which Mr Johnson is bound by legislation passed by opposition MPs, the Benn Act or the Surrender Act, depends who you ask, which requires the government to request an extension to Brexit deadline if a deal has not been signed off by Parliament by 19th October. Lord Pentland will hear arguments on Friday about what consequences of Prime Minister not doing this would be, with petitioners suggesting penalties including a fine, right? That's called crowdfunding. I don't think the fine would particularly worry Boris. An imprisonment, which is absolutely, I think, insane. The judge will rule on this, and initial part of the case on Monday, after which the panel of the inner house judges will consider whether the court could use its nobile officium power to effectively sign a letter to European leaders if Mr. Johnson declined to do so. This was discussed on Radio 4 in a bizarre sequence to which no one on Radio 4, BBC Radio 4, seemed to bat an eyelid, in which they were talking about the courts, meaning the Court of Session, taking over Boris Johnson's legal personality. We must talk more about what the significance of that is, because you're not a person, you have a person. So the legal personality of the Prime Minister will be seized, they're suggesting, by the Court of Session, and operated like a sock puppet in order to force this country to enter into treaty obligations with a foreign power. This is...
So, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but entering into treaty obligations with a foreign power is a matter for the royal prerogative, and the official who handles the royal prerogative is the Prime Minister. His signature is the only one that would do. And this seems to be sort of a variation on something that was doing the rounds a few weeks ago, where there was a suggestion that that Mark Sedwell could sign on Boris Johnson's behalf if Boris Johnson refused to do it. This is even taking it a step further, taking it out of government completely. But
it's worse than that. It's worse than that, Mike. They're not saying Boris Johnson wouldn't sign. They're saying Boris Johnson would sign. It's just... It's like a skin suit of Boris Johnson. It's the legal personality of Boris Johnson. It's the Boris Johnson puppet being operated by the Court of Session with their hand, you know, making everything work. They're talking about Boris Johnson as a legal personality being captured by a court and operated against the will of the flesh and blood human being called Boris Johnson.
Yes, the implications of that are massive. Now, who is this Dan Vince guy then?
He is a businessman, and he's got an unusual backstory, from living in a caravan to helping build the UK's green energy sector and owning the world's first vegan football club, says Business Leader. His rise in business world to become chief executive of a renewable energy company is not a conventional one. So he's gone from being a new age traveller to being a multimillionaire. And his politics is far left. This is his blog, Zero Carbonista, right, which is using words which sound like the anti-fascist movement of violent extreme left-wing thugs. So he's using similar sounding language to signal his far-left credentials. His company is called Ecotricity, and Ecotricity Group Limited, here's an extract from their accounts, 2018. So you see their turnover was 175 million. So they're substantial funds. And from that, there was a small adjusted profit of 110,000. So not massively profitable, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. The Telegraph, a couple of years ago, did a very interesting piece on him and his company and some of the ways it gets its funding. So this is Robert McKendrick, the chief reporter of Telegraph, writing February 2015. He's saying the wind tycoon and the donations to Labour and the £36 million in subsidies. Dale Vince's company's Ecotricity has given £250,000 to the Labour Party, whose energy policies it has been a major beneficiary of. Dale Vince has done all right for a former hippie, reckoned to be Britain's wealthiest green energy tycoon. He lives in a castle, drives a £750,000 electric sports car, and sits on a fortune of £100 million. And they go on, Telegraph investigation into Mr. Vince's financial dealings suggests he had reason to be grateful to the Labour Party, and particular to Mr. Miliband, who ran the Department of Energy and Climate Change for 2 years during the Gordon Brown premiership. An examination of official government data shows Ecotricity presently receives in the region of £6 million a year through a generous subsidy introduced by the Labour Party to encourage renewable energy. In total, Ecotricity, which Mr. Vince wholly owns, has been paid £36 million. This is more now, this is in 2015. £36 million in subsidies since 2002 when the scheme began. It then goes on to discuss things including a £3 million interest-free loan that the company gave Mr. Vince just before they bought a castle for £2.8 million. So he's doing nicely, but he's doing nicely on government subsidy, for which everyone who pays an electricity bill is ultimately generating through their hard work. And he's now taking some of that money to defend the state and the organisation and the corporate welfare that has made him so wealthy.
Absolutely. Now, we're nearly out of time, but I just want to say that if people like what we're doing here at the UK Column would like to support us, then please get over to ukcolumn.org/community. And there are ways to support us there. It'd be much appreciated. And a quick reminder that Ian R. Crane is continuing his 5G Is It Safe tour. He's been right around the country. But tonight he will be in Edinburgh and then in Glasgow on Monday, Belfast on Tuesday, Swansea on Thursday, and Cardiff next Friday. And that is the end of that particular tour. And then I think we could maybe end off.
Oh, I think we should.
Brian, with the news that Rory Stewart has stepped down as MP for Penrith and the Borders, and in fact has left the Conservative Party as well. And so why has he done this? Because he intends to run as candidate, independent candidate for Mayor of London. David Scott, this is fantastic news.
Well, I was deeply struck by this. And even more struck by the response from David Lammy, who said, and I quote, "Sadiq Khan has been a unifying force for London at a time when the country has been divided." So there you go. If that's not comedy gold, I don't know what is.
Well, indeed.
I just think it's a bit of sour grapes because, of course, Rory was taken off to a Bilderberg meeting and I think he got ideas above his station that they were going to make him Prime Minister. They didn't. Maybe he's being offered Mayor of London.
Well, maybe he thinks that if Boris could do it, he can do it too.
Absolutely. So we've got Florence of Arabia, as he's known, will be running London, possibly.
David Ellis, closing comments.
Get those letters into your MP. Demand an audience if you can. Get in and see him. And it's the letters that they fear. You know, we want the truth, as Lord James says. You know, what does defence union entail regardless of Brexit? Keep it short and sweet, but don't back off. We've got to double down now. Next couple of weeks, it's going to be big time.
Absolutely.
I'll just add to that, if you get a FOBOFF letter, that is great, because FOBOFF letters that are template show that MPs are not even thinking anymore. So don't be put off by those letters. Keep them. You can send a copy into the UK column. We want to be able to show the fact that the agenda is now not being decided by functioning MPs. We've got David Scott's has described it as a government of occupation. I think that's what it is. That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. If you're not a subscriber of UK Column, please consider taking out a subscription or making a donation. We can only do what we do with your continued financial support. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.